Talk given Sunday, 9th May 1976. We have all heard of this terrible disaster, the earthquake in Europe, bringing death, distress, deep suffering to hundreds of people. We here, who are somewhat distant from the actual scene of the disaster, hear the news, experience some sort of reaction, some sort of response to the fact, but on the whole, since it doesn't touch us personally, unless of course we have friends or relatives who were actually involved in the disaster, tend to remain in little islands by ourselves. There are also other aspects of human suffering all the world over, all the time. There is personal illness. If we are of a certain age and we feel that we are coming towards the end of our life, there is the problem of one's own death and questioning about it. There are fears and various other states of mind which overtake us in that connection. The great religions of the world have invented all kinds of theories with regard to a hereafter, and have tried to support these theories with what people call evidence. But none of us can deny that suffering in some form or other is an ever-present fact in our lives. And it is very difficult to deny that the bulk of human beings tend to avert their eyes from suffering, except and unless it touches them personally very strongly, or it touches someone very near and dear to them. There are so many things which are positively evil to in the world, and we tend to shut our eyes to all that, to condone it, or if we are that sort of person, we react with violence against it. As for instance, in the name of justice, social justice, honor, and all the rest of it. And the forgetting that our reacting with violence is only a perpetuating of the ill state. Perhaps not that particular ill state, but we introduce another ill state. Because violence breeds violence, hate breeds hate. That is no way out. And there are those who, out of sheer good-heartedness, but nevertheless hampered by lack of inward wisdom, deliberately set out to do good. Deliberately set out to spread love, cooperation, helpfulness, and all the rest of it. Forgetting that any one of us, I, the individual, who am ignorant myself, who am incapable on the whole, whose mind is imperfect, who suffers from inner conflicts, I myself needs to be whole, healthy, capable, wise, spontaneously and naturally loving and understanding and skillful. Otherwise, that which I attempt to do is always spoilt by my own insufficiencies. My own egoism and vanity needs satisfaction. Therefore, I rush out into the world doing good deliberately. It is the deliberation which introduces the difficulties, because all deliberation has at the back of it some sort of criterion for judging. And the criterion of myself in the worldly state of mind and consciousness is always tinged, spoilt by worldly criteria, which are always self-centered, which are always enclosed within the sphere of ambivalence, which means the sphere of conflict. These are difficulties which mankind as a whole does not see. And if one has the intellectual ability, the intellectual power to perceive that, one just sees it intellectually and finds himself either completely thwarted or tries to bypass the defect. It cannot be done that way. This does not mean that one should be supine and not contribute what it is possible for one to contribute, what one must of necessity contribute in the immediate moment because of the immediate need. If we understand these things intellectually only, the circumstance will compel us to act with all our deficiencies playing their part in the acting. And then when things don't come quite right, we tend to suffer pangs. Oh, I did wrong there. We get a guilt conscience, and so forth and so forth. There's no use having a guilt conscience. See the fault, recognize it, but see it with a mind that is calm and poised. If one is going to be upset about it, one will never really see the truth. And insofar as one succeeds in truly penetrating into the truth of the whole matter, the defect within oneself becomes transformed into faculty for skilled action. This is the point. We look at it the wrong way. We want to get rid of our defects. You can't get rid of a defect. Supposing I was born with, what shall I say, a cauliflower ear. Well, I've got a cauliflower ear. That's all. I've got to get on with the job. It's no good trying to get rid of the ear. If there is a way of curing it, all right, do so. But what is cure? What is healing? Making whole, which involves a process of the transformation of what is not well, what is not right. You don't throw it out of the window. You have to transform it, convert it. So all our defects within ourselves, whether they be physical or psychological, are not to be fought against, not to be overcome as is commonly taught in the world, but to be so fully understood that that psychical or physical energy which has found ill expression is now trained in the right way to find right expression. This is a very important point. All right. Now this involves, of course, having a right understanding. And do remember that understanding in the religious sense means compassionate wisdom wedded to wise compassion. We have to approach everything with right understanding. Now we started all this with reminding ourselves of the fact of the disaster that has recently taken place in Europe, and also of the fact that illness, death and so forth is always present with us. With regard to this matter of the right approach, the right approach from the point of view of the religia, from the religious point of view. And do remember that the religious point of view does not mean in actual fact a particular separate point of view different from the business point of view or the political point of view or any other worldly point of view. Religion is that which includes the totality of life and completely touches and influences the totality of life. We have a limited concept of religion. It's a hopelessly wrong concept, hopelessly limited anyway. Religion deals with transcendence, and transcendence is not out there, something different from, other than us, unrelated to us. It is wholly other than us insofar as it is still outside our consciousness, outside our capabilities. And our task is so to grow as pure and perfect human beings that the transcendent finds no obstruction in flowing freely through us and influencing everything in our moment-to-moment everyday life. So the context of religion being the context of transcendence is really the context of the totality of existence, of all existence. Now this is something which mankind as a whole just does not understand. The brain may say, oh yes, that's a fine idea. But saying that's a fine idea is totally ineffective and useless. Having said it's a fine idea, I say goodbye, attempt to walk the street, and swear at the motorist who suddenly swerved past to avoid us. Where is the fine idea? The car ran over it, I'm afraid. You see, It's like that. If one really understood, if one really responded, then this, what we commonly call the fine idea, is total part and parcel of us. It is an of course with us in our lives. It is second nature, so to say. In fact, I would almost like to say it is first nature, primary nature. The true man is a religious man in that sense. He is indeed the Son of Man, to use Christian terminology, who is the Son of God. The pure, sinless Son of Man is the Son of God. And that is the true meaning of the word human. Now, what have the great religions taught in depth with regard to the approach to disaster, to pain, to suffering, to illness, to death? I have selected something from the Buddhist scriptures today because the Buddhist approach has a certain originality about it, which I haven't come across in any of the other religions. Remember that every religion is rooted in transcendence. And whatsoever religion has put out for human beings is with the specific intent that human beings shall realize transcendence. Which means not that the individual achieves or attains, but becomes such a pure, unselfed, true individual that transcendence functions freely through him. Just as when the body is healthy, this mysterious thing which we call life energy functions freely and unhindered through the body, so too transcendence functions freely through the whole man. Now, with regard to the Buddhist approach, you know there are instances throughout the Pali texts of monks who were ill, so ill that they were near death. And then, quite naturally, they send a message to the Enlightened One and or to one of the senior disciples, the senior monks, to visit them. Now, this was not merely for the purpose of alleviating their own personal suffering, or in the hope that they might perform a miracle and raise the man up hale and hearty. Not at all. This is a point which we have to really grasp, really understand. Their sights were set on transcendence, not on self-perpetuation. So now, when the monk falls ill, and either the Buddha or one of the senior monks comes, what is recorded as a conversation in the texts takes place. And I have chosen this particular one, a monk whose name was Dhananjani. Dhananjani. And it's rather interesting that in the introductory part, there is a little account given about him. Sariputta, the great disciple of the Buddha, was asked by another disciple how the order of monks was getting on. how the Buddha himself was, whether he was well and in well and fit and happy, so to say. And in each case, the answer was in the affirmative. Then he asks, Sariputta, I hope, Your Reverence, addressing Sariputta, that the Brahman Dhananjani is being diligent. And Sariputta answers, how could the Brahman be diligent, Your Reverence? Under the king's patronage, the Brahman plunders Brahman householders. And under the patronage of the Brahman householders, he plunders the king. His wife, who had faith and whom he had married, has died, and he has married another wife who has no faith and comes from a family that has no faith. This is indeed sad news, Your Reverence. And he tells Sariputta, perhaps sometime, somewhere, we might meet the Brahman Dhananjani. Well, the meeting takes place. Sariputta goes and sees him. And Sariputta, after the usual exchange of courtesies, it's one of the wonderful features of everything mentioned in the text, that whenever they meet, they always exchange the greetings and compliments of politeness and courtesy. No disrespect of another person, no invalidating another person, whoever he may be. And Sariputta asks, I hope that you are being diligent, Dhananjani. How could I be diligent, good Sariputta, when there are my parents to support, my wife and children to support, my slaves, servants and workpeople to support, when there are services to perform for friends and acquaintances, services for kith and kin, for guests, when there are rites to perform for the ancestors, rites for the devatas, that is the tutelary deities, for the king, and this body, referring to his own physical body too, must be satisfied and looked after. Now it's rather interesting. That paragraph sums up a good many of the excuses I make, most of us make, for not being diligent in living the religious life. That means not going 5 times to church on Sundays and 3 times every other day and all that sort of stuff, but in the profound sense, the discipline of the mind and the heart, the mindfulness, the practice, and so forth, the daily 24-hour-a-day practice, you see. So we always raise up these excuses, don't we? And in the modern world, we do it in modern terms. But now look, Sariputta asks, what do you think about this, Dhananjani? Suppose someone were an irreligious man because he has to look after his parents. Would the guardians of hell drag him down to hell or not? And Dhananjani answers, yes, the guardians of hell would certainly drag him down into hell if he lives irreligiously on account of his parents. The same question is repeated again and again, substituting for parents, wife, child, this, that, and everything that concerns daily life. And the answer is the same every time. Then the reverse situation is presented. But supposing you live religiously because of your parents, because you have to look after your parents, because you have to support your wife and child and servants and whatnot and all the rest of it. then would the guardians of hell drag you down into hell? No, says Dhananjani. And so in that way the conversation goes on until he comes to the positive aspect in which different states of realization are presented. Is this a good state? Is this a better state? Is that a still better state? And so on. Sariputta asks the question, and Dhananjani in each case says, yes, that would be a better state. Then he comes to the point when he mentions the Brahma world, the Brahma Loka. Brahma is the creator god of the Hindus. And Brahma has both meanings really, as creator, creator god, and also as meaning the best. The meaning of the best comes into the Buddhist sphere only after the actual lifetime of the Buddha, despite what other scholars say. Remember that the Buddha lived and flourished in Brahmanical India. He spoke the language of the people. Therefore, when he uses the word Brahma, he uses it in the sense that the people around him use. You see? And there is no record of him actually offering any explanation, saying that I am using the word Brahma only to signify the superlative adjective best. He doesn't do that at all anywhere. All right. So when he comes to this Brahma world, the Brahman Dhananjani suddenly responds very intensely. And Sariputta thinks, right, this man is interested in this matter. I will establish him in the Brahma world. Show him how to establish himself. And he gives the usual teaching about filling his mind with loving kindness, with compassion, with sympathetic joy at the advancement and progress of others, and with perfect equanimity. You know, the usual metta, karuna, mudita, upekha. And having said that, the text goes on to say, although there was something further to be done, the Venerable Sariputta established the Brahman Dhananjani in the less, in a Brahma world only, and did not establish him in the supreme teachings with regard to making a complete end of all ill, to true liberation, to nirvana. And he goes away. And then he tells the Buddha what he had done. And the Buddha says, but why did you, Sariputta, although there was something further to be done, having established the Brahman Dhananjani only in the less, in the Brahma world, depart? Sariputta says, it occurred to me, Lord, these Brahmins are very intent on the Brahma world. So I showed him the way to companionship with Brahma. Sariputta, says the Buddha, the Brahman Dhananjani has died and has realized only the Brahma world. Because he fell ill, you see. Dhananjani fell ill. It was only when he fell ill that he sent for Sariputta specially. Now, reading the texts as such, we easily get misled by the words. This is not simply a matter of a conversation. There are about four or five such discourses dealing with different Brahmins, and different monks, where the conversation proceeds generally along certain stereotype lines, and then is different for each different monk, according to the status and the condition of the monk. Now, this is not a mere conversation. The key comes with the word established in. What is the meaning of established in this case? It means, here are two people, one who has realized perfection, who released the dormant powers of the mind within himself, one of which is the power to transmit a mental energy so powerful that it enables the listener, if he is attending fully, to realize that state of consciousness. And in the realizing of that state of consciousness, there takes place the transformation within the psyche of what ill there is present. As it is put in Buddhist terms, the seeds of rebirth. In Hindu terms, in the Upanishads you find them through and through, the vasanas, as they are called. In modern terminology, modern psychological terminology, the unworked out mental impressions which remain as blocks within the psyche which do harm to the individual and, of course, also to his environment. So now, in this sort of transmission of spiritual power, psycho-spiritual power, just as the functioning of the living organism is a psycho-physical power and energy, this is a psycho-spiritual power which the developed person can transmit directly to the other. The conversation may or may not take place. There are instances not connected with illness where there is a direct transmission of mind to mind without any spoken words. See? So this is a process of transformation. You have examples given in the Upanishads also of this direct transmission from one being to another being. And in the second book of Kings, you have a most wonderful account of precisely this kind of thing. The famous Elijah-Elisha journey together before Elijah is taken up in a chariot of fire by a whirlwind. If you study that chapter, I think it's the second chapter of the second book of Kings. I'm not quite certain, but it's somewhere there, you see. And if you understand it, if you really understand it, you will see what is happening. Take the name Elijah. It means God himself. All these old people had extraordinary names like that. If you look at the Rig Veda, you have Prajapati Parameshtin, for instance. Prajapati means lord of creatures, Parameshtin the supreme being. What a pseudonym to assume. Either the person is incredibly megalomaniac, or he is precisely what he says, only he says it in the ear of the one worthy to receive it. And the one worthy to receive is called the son of the teacher, the son of the prophet. Elijah means God himself. Elisha means God the Savior. You know, remember they go through Gilgal first, the round of earthly existence and experience. Then they reach Bethel, the house of God, Bethel. The Bethel also means the containing vessel of God. Now the containing vessel of God means that it is the contained made manifest. The contained made manifest. The supreme, the unknown, the unknowable, made visible in human form. That is the real meaning of Bethel. And in each case, you remember, there are the 50 sons of the prophets who say to Elisha, "Know you not that your master will be taken from your head?" Taken from your head. And Elisha says, "Yes, I know." And he more or less tells them to shut up, because not to disturb him. And they go on together to the next place, Jericho, which means, the name means the place of fragrance. You study the Kaushitaki Upanishad and you will find precisely this term, the place of fragrance. And the fragrance of Brahma reaches him, the disciple, as he approaches Brahma in profound meditation. And then they come to the Jordan. The meaning of the word Jordan is not quite certain, but it could very well mean the parting of the ways. The parting of the ways. Now, having gone together, mind transmitting to mind, there comes the point of departure. And then Elijah turns to Elisha and says, "Ask what thou wilt." And Elisha says, "May a double portion rest upon me." The Jewish custom, the eldest son receives twice as much as each of the other sons of what the father bequeaths. And Elijah says, "Thou hast asked for a hard thing, but so be it unto thee, if thou seest me as I am being taken up." And then, as you know, suddenly there is this chariot of fire. And Elisha does see. He says, my father, the horsemen of Israel." Israel means he who strives with God, and striving successfully, not striving against, striving with, striving successfully with God, he rules with God. That is the real meaning of Israel. And the horsemen of Israel means the powers which are the supreme psycho-spiritual powers that can be developed in human beings. So, as Elijah goes up by that whirlwind in a chariot of fire, his mantle, the Shekhinah, the glory as it is called, falls upon Elisha. And Elisha is the successor of Elijah. And you'll notice he performs similar miracles to Elijah. Elijah raised the dead child and brought him to life and so forth. So there is this transmission from mind to mind, this establishing one in a state of awareness which brings about such utter purification within the being that he is utterly liberated. Now, there is the old traditional teaching that if at the moment of death one's attention is completely concentrated upon Brahman, this is the Upanishadic statement, upon the ultimate real, upon the supreme truth, and remember that truth is not in words or concepts, forms or shapes, it is a state of being which is transcendent. If one's attentiveness is completely centered on that, then he escapes by the channel from the heart which goes through the sagittal suture in the head. Now these are all symbolic ways of talking. Remember, these people were masters of yoga. They knew just precisely what they were talking of. Today people have forgotten all these secrets, and they have to be discovered, rediscovered. It's not easy to rediscover them. And going through the sagittal suture, there is no return to existence. I am using the word existence. They use the word samsara to the round of births and deaths, interpreted by them in the reincarnational sense, which I say is the false sense. Because the reincarnational picture is a mistaken picture, an inadequate and a misleading picture, somewhat misleading picture, of the profound reality, the profound truth which lies behind it all. It's not altogether false, but its presentation is too naive and too inadequate. There is a tremendous reality involved in it. I have tried in my new book to, especially towards the end, you will find something which perhaps makes it a little less misleading, because no one can present transcendence in words. It's absurd. We can only be less misleading, that is all, and less inadequate. So now, this is what happens. The transcendent reality is fulfilled. And it is in death that the supreme fulfillment takes place. Because where there is death in the real sense, it is not a destruction. It is not, certainly not an annihilation. No such thing as annihilation ever can take place anywhere. It is consummation, it is perfection. The limited, finite being, despite being enclosed in finitude, realizes infinity, realizes the absolute in mind and consciousness. The mind becomes what, as we usually say, completely empty. The soul stands naked before eternal God, as the mystics of the world have put it, stands naked. The naked soul means that there are no blocks in that mind at all. No psychoses, no neuroses, no fixations of any sort to obstruct the light of totality, the light of transcendence. See? And so, because the religious life means that our sights are set on transcendence, this is the meaning of these conversations. What is put in the form of conversation is a tremendous psycho-spiritual activity going on between master and disciple. Now, death grave, where is thy victory? Death, where is thy sting? Into what is the finite then liberated by death? From finite imprisoned being, there is liberation. Note carefully, I'm not saying you are liberated into. There is liberation into the infinite totality, the infinite non-being. Out of existence, which means a standing away from, out of transcendence. The word existence means to stand out of, ex sistere, from the Latin. You see, you have gone right beyond that. And in the going, any identifiable entity, which means a limitation, is no more. Transcendence has realized its manhood through you, the living individual. Now, if we approach illness, death, disaster with some sort of understanding along these lines, we can deal with it as pure, free human beings.